Hi, I'm Sandy Nelson. I'm an ID physician at Massachusetts General Hospital. I will be talking about bone and joint infections. This is a topic that should feel pretty familiar to you, but the types of questions that you might be asked on the boards are a little bit more limited, as the data that informs many of our decisions are also limited and practice varies. So there is the types of questions you might see on the board may not be what you feel are representative of the types of problems that you're seeing in practice. I'm going to focus on some general principles that really just serve as a foundation for the questions that you might see. And then I'll also discuss some of the less common osteoarticular infection syndromes that you need to be aware of, but may be less likely to see in clinical practice. I have no disclosures. We're going to go ahead and start with osteomyelitis. And I think I will start with a question. We have a 57-year-old male. He presented with 3 months of progressive lower back pain. He didn't have any fevers or chills, but he did report some weight loss. He was born in Cambodia. He emigrated to the United States when he was younger. At the time of his presentation, he did have elevated inflammatory markers. His seborrheic was 84 and C-reactive protein was 16. And you can see his MRI here, which was interpreted as showing discitis osteomyelitis in the lower lumbar spine at the L5-S1 level. Blood cultures were collected and grew staph epidermidis in 2 of 4 bottles. So you are asked, what is the next best step in management? Here are your options. You could repeat some blood cultures. You could obtain an interferon gamma release assay. You could sample the disc space, start vancomycin with PICC-line placement for 6 weeks, or you could initiate treatment with antituberculous therapy. So we'll go ahead and give you a minute to think about it. Okay, the best answer is percutaneous biopsy of a disc space. Now, some of the other choices are not unreasonable. For example, you're probably going to check blood cultures and you'll probably check an interferon gamma release assay. But in and of themselves, those are likely to be insufficient to help you arrive at a diagnosis. I'll also note that coagulase negative staph is a fairly rare cause of hematogenous osteomyelitis in the absence of an indwelling line or direct inoculation like a steroid injection. You likely recognize that this is a patient with tuberculous osteomyelitis of the spine, but empiric treatment is not recommended prior to obtaining material for culture. So that is why the best answer is percutaneous biopsy of a disc space. And this is a case that is representative of vertebral osteomyelitis, but vertebral osteomyelitis of the pyogenic variety is somewhat different. That's what I'm going to focus on here. It is, in fact, one of the few areas in musculoskeletal infection in which there are useful ID guidelines. They're now about a decade old, the IDSA guidelines, but they are still relevant, and they really provide established diagnostic and treatment paradigms, and as such is really one of the topic areas for which the board can ask some of these questions. Now, radiographically, MRI is the best imaging test for early diagnosis. What you're seeing here is a T2 weighted image. It is showing discitis osteomyelitis at the L2, L3 level. What you can see here is a loss of disc height. There is also some bone marrow edema here. You might see some erosive changes here involving these end plates. Other changes that are not necessarily seen here is hyperintensity of the disc space and then paravertebral or epidural collections. Blood cultures are always the first step in diagnosis, and they are positive in about 60% of patients who present early. And if the blood cultures identify a pathogen or a convincing pathogen like Staph aureus or Staph lungdenensis, then there is not a need for additional diagnostic sampling. You can both confirm the diagnosis and infer that the microbial etiology is known. But if the if you do not recover these organisms or organisms that are likely to be pathogenic on blood culture, then the next step is generally going to be a percutaneous biopsy of the bone, disc space, and or paravertebral collections. It is reasonable to look for brucella and tuberculosis with non-invasive studies when there is epidemiology or clinical features that are relevant, but in and of itself, those are less likely to be sufficient for diagnosis. Sometimes the boards might ask if antibiotics should be held prior to sampling, and the current standard is for 2 weeks, as long as there's no evidence for sepsis or neurologic compromise. As I imagine many of you recognize, the case that I have just shared was of Pott's disease or tuberculosis involving the spine. And there were a few clinical features that should have led to the identification of that in the question. I'm going to review some of those here. One feature was its indolent course. Tuberculosis of the spine tends to be more indolent than bacterial osteomyelitis. It may also be associated with constitutional symptoms, but is not always associated with those. Radiographically, there are some important differences. While bacterial osteomyelitis is almost always an infection that starts in the disc space and then migrates to the adjacent vertebral bodies, both above and below, tuberculosis of the spine actually starts in this subligamentous space. You can see here with these arrows. And really, it propagates from anterior to posterior. And so it's not unusual to find anterior involvement greater than posterior involvement. Discs are actually involved later in the course, and so sometimes tuberculosis of the spine can be thought of as disc sparing. Over time, there can be collapse of the anterior portion of the vertebral bodies relative to the posterior portion, and that gives you this gibbous deformity. This is most common in the thoracic spine, and it really manifests as a kyphotic deformity. Now, the other features that are typical for tuberculosis is the presence of these large paravertebral epidural space, paraspinal space, fluid collections, which you can see here, and also involvement of multiple levels of the spine. Discitis, iagenic vertebral discitis osteomyelitis generally involves two vertebral bodies that are adjacent. Sometimes there may be skip lesions in a patient with high-grade bacteremia, but tuberculosis of the spine can involve multiple contiguous vertebral bodies, and again, these large paravertebral fluid collections. So if you see these features, you should be thinking tuberculosis. Now, the other form of native osteomyelitis that is a favorite of the boards is subacute hematogenous osteomyelitis, sometimes called a Brody's abscess. Now, this is typically seen in children and young adults, but can be seen in adults. And it is a hematogenous infection. Organisms are inoculated, typically in the metaphyseal component of the bone, sort of closer between the thinner shaft and the splayed epiphysis here. This is the metaphyseal portion of bone. And that is highly vascular. And that is why organisms tend to land in this portion of the bone. Now, once the organism is inoculated through the bloodstream, then the host response begins, and that includes osteolysis. With osteolysis, you'll get this loosened area of bone here that can sometimes be mistaken for tumor. On MRI, you will sometimes see this characteristic feature of a penumbra, which is a double line here. You can see it well up here or over here. There's essentially two sort of sclerotic borders with a loosened area between the two. The inner border is granulation tissue that lines the cavity, the abscess cavity, and the outer border is usually sclerotic tissue, which is the bone sort of attempting to wall it off. And this double lucency, this is called a penumbra, and that is really pathognomonic for a Brody's abscess if you should see this. Now, Staph aureus, like many forms of bone and joint infections, is the most common pathogen to cause this, but really many other organisms can also cause a Brody's abscess. Now, those vertebral osteomyelitis and subacute hematogenous or Brody's abscesses are both forms of hematogenous osteomyelitis. And I will leave you with a few testable points about this. So first, starting with imaging, MRI is going to be the most sensitive test early in diagnosis. It's not perfect. It's not highly specific, but it is quite sensitive. So that should be your first imaging test to go to an early infection. Later in infection, somebody who's presenting with weeks to months of symptoms, plain films and CT are actually more useful because in these, you'll be able to see bony erosion. And erosion is really more characteristic than, say, bone marrow edema, which is what's seen on MRI. Or I should say it's more specific. Now, bone scan is really only useful as a rule-out test. It has very poor specificity. It can be used to exclude a diagnosis of infection if it is negative, but a positive test should never be used to confirm infection. And importantly, there is not an imaging test which can be used as a test of cure. So for most patients, diagnoses can really only be confirmed through bone histopathology and culture. You know, having said that, clinically, and I think also on the boards, there will be times when seeking bone sampling is not feasible, and we may need to initiate treatments in the absence of confirmatory diagnostic testing. I'm not going to speak much about molecular diagnostics. I don't see this as being something that the boards will ask you about. In general, I think the only role for molecular testing, and by that I mean PCR or next generation sequencing, is really to inform microbial etiology in the setting of culture negativity, but it can really never be used to confirm the presence of infection. Now, treatment paradigms are changing, and as such, I think these are going to be areas that are more difficult for the boards to question you about. Typically, we think about 6 weeks of antimicrobial therapy, and that still is probably going to be the best answer in most circumstances. And we'll talk a little bit more in the coming minutes about oral therapy. All right. Now, what I mentioned earlier was were cases of hematogenous osteomyelitis. I just briefly want to mention diabetic foot osteomyelitis, which, unlike those prior topics, is a generally what considered a contiguous osteomyelitis. So there's some hematogenous and contiguous. Contiguous occurs when there is infection of the adjacent structures, usually soft tissue structures. Now, for diabetic foot infection, the probe to bone test is both sufficiently specific and sensitive that it can be used. I should say it's mostly specific more than sensitive, but it can be used when positive to confirm diabetic foot osteomyelitis. I will also highlight that this is not true of other forms of osteomyelitis. A positive probe to bone test in a decubitus ulcer, for example, in the patient with spinal cord injury, is not sufficient to confirm osteomyelitis. Superficial cultures should not be used to inform microbial etiology. Deeper sampling, preferably of bone, but in the absence of bone sampling, then a deep ulcer base culture formed after debridement or collected after debridement would be considered optimal. There is no need to empirically target Pseudomonas unless a patient is presenting with a severe infection, moderate to severe presentation, and specifically if there is evidence of moistness. Either the ulcer is macerated or the individual lives in a tropical or humid climate. And this is stemming from data that was used to inform the most recent set of guidelines. The International Working Group of the Diabetic Foot put out guidelines in 2023. Because these have been out for general use now for several years, I do think these are fair game for the boards. One of the surprises here that I think surprised some of us, many of us, is on treatment duration. And so I just highlighted that for inclusion here. And this is in the setting of diabetic foot osteomyelitis. The variable treatment durations according to the completeness, the role of surgical debridement, and the completeness of said debridement. And I just wanted to point out that even in the setting of residual osteomyelitis, either because of a positive bone culture or a positive bone histopathology, a treatment is still only 3 weeks. 6 weeks is really reserved for the absence of surgical debridement or the presence of residual non-viable bone. Okay, staying with the topic of native bone and joint infections, I'm going to turn to septic arthritis, and we'll go ahead and start with a question. We have a previously healthy young woman. She developed acute right thumb pain followed by bilateral ankle pain and swelling, which led to the inability to ambulate. She was treated with NSAIDs but had no relief. On exam, she's afebrile. Her right thumb metacarpophalangeal joint was red and warm, and there were bilateral ankle effusions, and she guards against movement of both the thumb and the ankles. Plain films showed bilateral tibiotalar effusions. I have listed her laboratory studies here. She has a mild leukocytosis. Her inflammatory markers were elevated. She had a positive ANA and a low titer speckled pattern, and she underwent arthrocentesis of the right ankle with recovery of 34,000 white cells per microliter, of which the majority were neutrophils, with a negative Gram stain and no crystals. You are asked, while synovial fluid cultures are pending, what is your next best step? Should you measure an anti-citrullinated peptide antibody, obtain an HLA-B27 test, initiate treatment with glucocorticoids, obtain blood cultures, cervical nucleic acid amplification testing, and initiate antibiotics, or should she proceed to bilateral ankle arthrotomy and debridement procedures? I will give you a minute to think about that. Okay, so this case is asking you to determine if septic arthritis has been definitively ruled out. You'll note that there was no epidemiology shared here, so this is really just a presentation based on data. Now, this individual has a culture-negative inflammatory oligoarthritis. And the correct answer here is that septic arthritis has not been excluded, and therefore this patient should be considered for the possibility of septic arthritis. She should be initiated on antimicrobial therapy while these diagnostic studies are pending. All right, so a couple of clinical pearls on septic arthritis. You know, like osteomyelitis, it is a fairly heterogeneous condition. And so there are not altogether a lot of truisms that I can share, but I will talk a little bit about the diagnostics and what to think about in the setting of certain types of septic arthritis. So first is around the threshold by which synovial fluid cell counts can inform the likelihood of infection. And the reality is that there really isn't a diagnostic threshold. And while there is a higher probability of septic arthritis if the white cell count is elevated over 50,000, lower cell counts don't exclude septic arthritis. And in some studies, 25 to 40% of septic arthritis that is confirmed will have lower cell counts than 50,000. This is seen more commonly in individuals who are immunocompromised and also with organisms that may be more indolent. Now, this individual, actually, you're waiting for a culture, so we don't necessarily have negative cultures, but that is a question that is sometimes asked. And if you do see a person with negative cultures and or their culture positivity is delayed, these are some organisms that you should think about: gonococcus, the Hayseq organisms, Lyme, and mycoplasma. Now, most septic arthritis is monoarticular, about 80%, and that typically involves the knee. If you do see a septic arthritis that involves one of the axial joints, like the sternoclavicular joint or the sacroiliac joint, you should think about injection drug use as a potential mediator of that infection. It has a predilection for axial joints. In the sacroiliac joint, you should think about Brucella. Brucella has a predilection for this joint, the SI joint. Now, while the majority of septic arthritis is monoarticular, about 10 to 20% is oligoarticular or polyarticular. And these questions should lead you to think about a couple of different categories. One of them is the patient who also has bacteremia or sepsis. This is generally not going to be subtle. And these are patients who may be immunocompromised or have underlying central endovascular infection like endocarditis. But there are a few specific causes of polyarthritis that I want to highlight listed here, and I'll speak of these in a moment. We'll start with rat bite fever, which, as the name implies, is caused by a bite from a rat, potentially some other rodents, but primarily rats. And rats are, surprisingly to me, kept as pets. And therefore, rat bite fever is most commonly seen in children who have pet rats or those who work with rodents, either in pet stores or those that are working with rodents in the laboratory. Now, this can cause polyarthritis. And when it does, it is usually symmetric and it may be migratory. It is also typically associated with a rash, and the rash can look, it can appear differently. It may start out as a maculopapular eruption. There may be a pustular component, and then over time, it may become more vesicular with hemorrhage. Now, this is caused by Streptobacillus meliformis, but in other countries, it can be caused by other organisms, and the treatment of choice is penicillin. Another organism that can cause polyarthritis is gonococcus. And in its classic presentation of disseminated gonococcus, you'll see this triad of tenosynovitis, arthralgias, and skin lesions. I just want to highlight the osteoarticular features of disseminated GC because they are somewhat unique. Now, the arthralgias are not necessarily unique. They tend to be migratory. But the tenosynovitis of gonorrhea is unique in that it tends to involve extensor surface tendons, which is different than most other causes of infectious tenosynovitis, which tend to cause flexor tenosynovitis. And that's usually because of its direct inoculation in these other forms of tenosynovitis. Now, in addition to the triad, gonococcus can also cause purulent arthritis. So you may see purulent arthritis with components of the triad, or it may be seen independently. And this usually involves joints of the lower extremities, although not exclusively. And this is one of those arthritides for which lower synovial fluid cell counts are more common. Now, this organism, as you know, doesn't grow readily in culture. And therefore, the highest yield diagnosis is actually mucosal site sampling. You know, certainly you should send synovial fluid cultures and blood cultures, but higher yield to that is the synovial fluid, is the mucosal site sampling. There are certainly times, and this would be true on the boards as well, when the clinical suspicion is high, but the diagnostics are negative. And because of the difficulty identifying this organism, it is still reasonable to treat if there is a compatible clinical syndrome. Now, many viruses can cause polyarthritis. There are some clues in general. These typically involve small joints, often of the hands and possibly the feet. They're typically associated with fever and rash. And the diagnosis of these is typically serologic or by viral PCR, sometimes from blood, sometimes from joint fluid. Now, there are a number of viruses that can cause arthritis. I've listed some of them here: rubella, parvovirus B19, the viral hepatitis B and C, and then the alpha viruses especially chikungunya. Now, these entities are discussed in more detail elsewhere in the course. Certainly, one of the challenges, both clinically and on the boards, is going to be distinguishing between a septic arthritis and a crystalline arthritis, particularly that caused by gout. Now, gout may be associated with fever. It can be monoarticular or polyarticular. There are a few clues that might point towards gout over septic arthritis, and these include the typical risk factors for gout, so alcohol use, chronic kidney disease, for example. Another feature is that the clinical course tends to be hyperacute. So as opposed to septic arthritis, in which patients will develop symptoms that reach peak intensity within maybe 12 hours, maybe up to 48 hours. With gout, they can reach peak intensity within hours. So this hyperacute onset to peak intensity is characteristic of gout. Now, CPPD is less likely a mimic of septic arthritis. It tends to cause a little bit more of a subacute or a chronic process as opposed to these acute, very angry flares. This also in acute CPPD arthritis, the synovial fluid cell counts tend to be a little bit lower, tend to be less likely to have fever, although there are some exceptions to that, of course, as well. I think one of the teaching points around the presence of CPPD crystals, because they are common, they oftentimes really can coexist with septic arthritis. And so the presence of crystals, this is going to be more true of CPPD than gout, but true of both. The presence of crystals should not exclude the possibility of septic arthritis. And that is somewhere a place that the boards might be able to trip you up. Now, of course, there are many other causes of non-infectious arthritis, and you certainly may be asked to distinguish these. I'm only going to focus here on reactive arthritis. I think because in part it is a post-infectious syndrome, it follows an episode of either diarrheal disease or genital mucosal disease. It is characterized by polyarthritis, oligo or polyarthritis affecting primarily the lower extremities. And the associated features are really what can sometimes be the clues. You might see an enthesitis, which is inflammation of the tendon insertions. You might see sausage digits. There can be mucosal involvement, the urethra, the conjunctiva, for example. And then there are these characteristic skin lesions, this often seen involving palms and soles, which is called keratoderma blenorrhagica. And so when you see that, that should make you think about reactive arthritis. But of course, the types of inflammatory polyarthritis are really protean, and I think it is important to be at least familiar with some of the more common forms. All right, now we're going to shift gears and discuss infections that occur in the setting of orthopedic surgery, and we'll start with a question. We have a 44-year-old healthy woman. She suffered a closed right ankle chelon fracture, and she underwent open reduction internal fixation. She had a wound that continued to drain despite courses of antibiotics. And then 2 months after her fixation procedure, her surgeon collected a deep wound culture, which grew Staph aureus. You can see the sensitivities here, but it is broadly susceptible to the usual suspects. Plain films that you can see here is the hardware is intact, although you can see that the fracture has not yet consolidated. And you can't quite see the tibial fracture on this image, but you can see the fibular one has not consolidated. So she's hospitalized. She started on IV antibiotics. And then the question is, what do you recommend next? So I will let you read these choices. They are asking you to consider both the need for surgery, the role of hardware removal, and then antimicrobial selection. So I'll give you a minute. Okay, so in this case, the correct answer is debridement without hardware removal, and then the treatment regimen that includes resample. So that is the correct answer here, and we'll unpack this in the next slide. So when we think about orthopedic device infections, and this is true of fracture infections as well as other types of infections, spinal implant infections, periprosthetic joint infection, our goal is not only to cure infection, it's also to preserve the mechanical outcome. And when you consider either the mechanics alone or infection alone, we'll sometimes have a compromised outcome really towards both ends. So as the clinician, you need to think both about fracture consolidation in the setting of a fracture-related infection and infection eradication. And both of those are going to inform decisions around surgical management, and surgical management then informs antimicrobial management. So for the purposes of the boards, fracture-related infections should be framed in, I'd say, two types. Those that occur early, prior to fracture consolidation, now these are usually going to be in the first 90 days, and then late infections, those that are either uncovered because the patient had a non-union and went to surgery, the late non-unions, or possibly in the setting of a draining sinus that occurs late. Now, early infections are generally going to be caused by pyogenic organisms, and the surgical management really is contingent upon fracture consolidation and the stability of the implants. Most commonly, the fracture is not yet united, and the implants, if they remain well fixed, are best if they are left in place to allow the fracture to continue to heal over time. So these patients should undergo a surgical debridement with retention of components. And antibiotic treatment is going to be pathogen specific, but generally durations of 4 to 6 weeks is appropriate, with consideration of suppression through around 12 weeks or until the fracture heals. Now, later infections are typically caused by more indolent organisms like coagulase negative staph or cutibacterium, and they're often identified at the time of surgery or because of development of a draining sinus. So with a late non-union, the surgeon has presumably already performed a procedure at which the hardware was removed and some form of a revision procedure was performed. And in these individuals, pathogen-directed therapy would be considered standard typically for about 6 weeks. For the late healed fracture that is manifesting with infection, then hardware removal is going to be the standard of care. And short courses of antibiotics, as little as 2 weeks following hardware removal, would be considered appropriate. Now, I'm going to turn briefly to antimicrobial treatment, and just to kind of put some of this into perspective, why this is a difficult area for the boards. There are actually very few drugs that are FDA approved for bone and joint infection. Most of what we do and use is considered off-label use. Comparative studies between different antimicrobial options are limited. There has been a lot of emphasis of late and duration of therapy, but these studies are really still ongoing. And I will say that there are not clearly established duration of therapy guidance in most areas. So I think that's a question that can be difficult for the boards to ask about. And then suppression is really a common topic of conversation. It is commonly used, but it is really highly variable. And I don't think that this is something that the boards will be likely to ask you about. But what they might ask you about is the role of oral antibiotics, which is now supported by a large body of both prospective and retrospective literature. And it supports oral therapy for essentially all forms of bone and joint infection, with very few exceptions, usually after an IV lead-in and after an individual has clinically responded to the initial sort of acute phase of infection. There are a few relative contraindications or exclusions. First, if there is not a suitable oral option, so for example, either based on susceptibilities or based on allergies, drug interactions, or the like, if there's not an oral option, then obviously you cannot use oral therapy. If there is a separate indication for IV therapy, so for example, the individual who has an endocarditis, if the gut isn't working well, the patient may have malabsorption or their NPO, And then finally, it's not as well studied for certain scenarios, including for drug-resistant infection and also in the setting of obesity. And that's not to say that it can't be used then, it's just not as well studied. So there are a large number of oral antimicrobials which are supported for the treatment of bone and joint infection. It used to be that we thought about bone penetration, but that sort of paradigm has fallen out of favor, and now we focus more on bioavailability. All of the drugs that I have listed here are drugs that are highly bioavailable and do have some data to support their use. The extent of that data is variable by the drug. And I will say that I don't think there is a preferred regimen. Although if you were asked in the setting of a staphylococcal periprosthetic joint infection, the regimen that has the most data to support it would be a combination therapy with a fluoroquinolone and rifampin. Outside of that, I don't think we could necessarily pick and choose based on literature. I do think rifampin is something that you might be asked about. It is often considered one of the few biofilm active drugs, although even that I think is a point of discussion. It is best studied for periprosthetic joint infection due to staphylococcus in the setting of hardware retention, so the debride and retain protocol, or like the osteofixation infection that we just discussed. The data has been extrapolated beyond periprosthetic joint infection to other implant-associated infections. It also has been evaluated for other organisms like Enterococcus and Cutibacterium, but I don't think that that data is sufficient for the boards to ask you about. So I think on the boards, the real indication would be for treatment of staph in the setting of hardware that has been retained. There are some specifics about how to use this. I imagine most of you feel pretty comfortable with this at this point. As I mentioned earlier, the evidence supports quinolones as the best partner drug, but there are many acceptable, reasonable alternatives. It should not be started prior to surgical debridement when debridement is planned, and not until that partner drug is therapeutic. So for example, if a patient's on vancomycin, you want to make sure that their levels are therapeutic before adding rifampin. And then, of course, there are multiple drug interactions to consider. Now we will turn to periprosthetic joint infection, or PJI. A word on diagnosis. There are really different forms of periprosthetic joint infection. Most of what we see would fall into this early category, so an early post-surgical infection, or a late acute form. So the patient essentially has a septic arthritis, but it happens to result an infection in a joint that also has a prosthetic joint. So a late hematogenous periprosthetic joint infection and an early prosthetic joint infection are more acute forms. And then there is a delayed chronic form, which is typically caused by organisms inoculated at the time of surgery, but tend to be more indolent. Now, the diagnosis of the early and the late hematogenous forms is fairly straightforward. But for chronic infection, it can actually be quite challenging. Now, there have been multiple sets of diagnostic guidelines that have been developed for periprosthetic joint infection, and new ones will be published soon. But what I think that you can remember, and really true to all the guidelines, has been that there are two major criteria, all of the guidelines really affirm are diagnostic of PJI. And those include the presence of a sinus tract that extends to the joint, or two, synovial fluid or periprosthetic tissue cultures that grow the same organism of an identical phenotype. And in those situations, infection can be confirmed. But that is not always the case, particularly preoperatively. And there are these minor criteria that can be employed. However, they're imperfect. And a word about some of those diagnostic tests, especially in chronic periprosthetic joint infection, inflammatory markers may be normal or only minimally elevated. Plain films can also be normal, although when they are abnormal, you may see this lucency here that is here. It's at the cement bone interface. You can see this is cement, this is bone, and between it you have this lucent line that is lucency, which can represent loosening, but loosening can also be aseptic. Synovial fluid aspiration is really the best preoperative diagnostic test, and I think what I want to highlight here is that the absolute cell counts that are really quite specific for infection, particularly in the chronic setting, are quite a bit lower than you would expect to see in the acute setting, particularly the acute native septic arthritis. And so cell counts in the 2,000 to 3,000 range would actually be highly suspicious, if not even diagnostic, for periprosthetic joint infection. There is a diagnostic test which is available, which measures the alpha defensin, which is a synovial, which is a antimicrobial peptide. It is elaborated by neutrophils and macrophages that are active, and it can be measured in synovial fluid. And when that test is positive, that's usually quite specific for periprosthetic joint infection. Now, from the standpoint of management, in general, the type of infection, whether it's an early infection, a late hematogenous infection, or a chronic infection, really dictates the surgical management. And then the surgical management dictates our antibiotic choices. I do think it is well within the realm of the boards to weigh in on both the best surgical strategy as well as the best antibiotic strategy for these different types of periprosthetic joint infection. So I'm going to review them quickly here. Now, the first surgical option is called debridement and implant retention. Sometimes the surgeons will refer to this as a DARE procedure, debridement, antimicrobial therapy, and implant retention. And this is utilized most commonly for early infections, early postoperative infections, and the late acute variety. Generally only when the components are well fixed. If there are any complications with respect to the implant, then implant removal is going to be preferred. Now, the treatment is an area that has evolved somewhat, but there is a good quality randomized controlled trial which looked at antibiotic duration. And this really has coalesced around 12 weeks of antibiotics for acute infections managed with debride and retain protocols. If the organism is staphylococcus, then rifampin should be added. There, of course, in clinical practice may be a role of suppression, but I don't think the boards will ask you about that. Now, the one-stage procedure is something that is not commonly used in the United States, but it is increasing in use. It's primarily used in acute infections, but it can also be used in chronic infections in which the soft tissues are healthy and the organism, if it is known, is one for which there are better outcomes. And treatment of this is going to be similar to that for debride and retain protocols. Now, in the United States, the two-stage procedure is the gold standard for a chronic periprosthetic joint infection, and it's really essential if there is a sinus tract or the presence of resistant organisms. Now, sometimes our surgeons will do a two-stage procedure without actually doing the second stage. So, for example, they will remove the device, place an antimicrobial spacer, but not then proceed with the second stage. Now, the standard of care for a two-stage procedure in which the entirety of the device is removed and an antibiotic spacer is employed is 6 weeks of antibiotics. I think in the setting of the retained antibiotic spacer, the destination spacer, sometimes our surgeons call it a 1.5-stage exchange. The antibiotic paradigms around that are still evolving, but 6 or 12 weeks would both be considered acceptable options. All right, our next question. We have a 57-year-old woman. She underwent a total hip arthroplasty, but never achieved a pain-free state. And between 1 and 2 years postoperatively, she was diagnosed with periprosthetic joint infection with Enterococcus faecalis. This was a sensitive strain of Enterococcus, and her orthopedist plans a two-stage exchange procedure utilizing a temporary spacer, which comprised of polymethyl methacrylate or cement, PMMA. You are asked to provide recommendations about both systemic and local antimicrobial therapy for this space. There are no allergies. Remember the sensitivities, as it's a broadly sensitive organism, at least as Enterococcus goes. So what would you advise? I will let you look at the options. I'll give you a minute. Okay. So the best answer here is C, gentamicin in the cement with systemic ampicillin. And I'm going to use this case to really highlight our understanding of antibiotics in local antibiotic delivered. Now, in the setting of a two-stage procedure in which the surgeon removes a chronically infected device, this leaves a void of space. And in that void of space, the surgeon will oftentimes put a construct in that preserves the mechanical structure. It preserves some stability of the joint to prevent the limb from being flail. It might allow some mobility and certainly prevents contractures, thereby facilitating reoperation. So though these devices were designed for mechanical purposes, we quickly learned that we can utilize them as an antibiotic delivery vehicle. And the antibiotics are introduced into the cement at the time of its polymerization. Now, just a couple of sort of truisms in thinking about antibiotic cement. In general, the antibiotic follows what's called a burst release kinetics. Very high levels of antibiotics are eluted within the first several days, and then they quickly fall off. But oftentimes there are detectable levels, even potentially over MIC, that may persist for weeks to even months. Not all antimicrobials can be fashioned within polymethyl methacrylate. There are obviously a number of considerations. Of course, first and foremost, you want to ensure that the antibiotic that is selected is active against the pathogen that is either known or suspected. But there are other features as well, including this thermal stability. Now, the reaction that produces cement, that polymerizes cement, is exothermic, and it achieves very high temperatures, and only antibiotics that can retain their structure and activity at these high temperatures are useful. So beta-lactam rings can be cleaved at higher temperatures. As a general rule, we avoid most beta-lactams in polymethyl methacrylate. Other antibiotics are limited by osteocyte toxicity. The most common antimicrobials that are used are vancomycin and aminoglycosides. Acute kidney injury is seen. Probably in up to 25% of patients will there be an increase in creatinine that is measurable, although it's not always important. And allergy is really thought to be quite rare. Now, in the closing minutes, I'm going to discuss the microbiology of musculoskeletal infection. So we'll start with a case. A 56-year-old man with poorly controlled diabetes presents to the emergency department with a one-week history of low-grade fevers and gradually progressive right knee pain and swelling. He traveled to the Dominican Republic 1 month ago, didn't have any illnesses while he was traveling. He last saw a dentist about 6 months ago and doesn't complain of any tooth pain, and he has no history of injection drug use. On exam, he has a moderate effusion and pain with passive range of motion. He has elevated inflammatory markers and underwent a synovial fluid sampling, which demonstrated inflammatory cells and a negative Gram stain. At 3 days of incubation, you see the Gram stain that I am showing you here. And this is in synovial fluid. And then the question is, what is the most likely organism? Guess the bug. I'll give you a minute. Okay, not quite a minute, but a few seconds. And in this case, the correct answer is B, Salmonella Heidelberg. This Gram stain is showing Gram negative organisms, which excludes Staph aureus. And then the distinction between the other Gram negative factor, Gram negative organisms, can be made by other demographic or epidemiologic factors. And so most osteoarticular infections are caused by staph, about 60%, and then another 15% or so are caused by strep. But then there are many other organisms that can cause musculoskeletal infection, and it's really important to recognize those in the right clinical or epidemiologic context. So I will say, in clinical practice, I really don't like playing guess the bug, but it is a favorite of the boards. So we are going to go ahead and play guess the bug, musculoskeletal edition. All right, this is going to be somewhat rapid fire. Salmonella, oftentimes seen in hosts with underlying risk factors, including sickle cell disease, those who are immunocompromised, those with diabetes, and it tends to cause hematogenous infections. So either septic arthritis, long bone abscess like a Brody's abscess, or vertebral osteomyelitis. Epidemiologic clues include exposure to reptiles, travel to the developing world, history of a prior GI illness, or unsafe food hygiene. These are not always, of course, present in a patient with a Salmonella infection. Serratius and Pseudomonas are both waterborne non-enteric Gram negatives, and they should be considered in a couple of settings. In the individual with an indwelling mine, we may see these organisms that are inoculated hematogenously via the line. Certainly injection drug use is a common mechanism for this for these organisms to be inoculated because they are common within tap water. And then, of course, we also see pseudomonal infections in the immunocompromised host. These, as I mentioned earlier, will have a predilection for the sacroiliac or the sternoclavicular joints when associated with injection drug use. And typically, we're going to see these causing hematogenous infection. All right, aphasic organisms. Again, these are usually going to be hematogenous. We think about these as common causes of culture-negative endocarditis, but they're also causes of culture-negative hematogenous musculoskeletal infection. A prior dental infection or dental work may be a clue, but is not always present or known. Eichenella, one of the E in HASEC, can be seen in the setting of human bite wounds. And Pingella, which is the K in HASEC, is actually the most common cause of osteoarticular infection in young children, young generally under four. This organism almost never grows in culture, and it is diagnosed by PCR. All right, Brucella. This is typically seen in persons who are from endemic areas, especially with the consumption of unpasteurized dairy products. Clinically, there may not be clues that allow you to land on the diagnosis of Brucella, except for the presence of a sacroiliitis, because Brucella does have a predilection for that joint. There may be undulating fevers prior to the onset of musculoskeletal infection. Clinically, patients with Brucella may have vertebral osteomyelitis, but there are not necessarily features that help to distinguish this from other pyogenic forms of vertebral osteomyelitis. Pasteurella. Now, this is generally seen in the setting of a dog bite or a cat bite, primarily cat bites, but can also be seen in persons who have pets at home. And this is because we share the flora with our pets. If we are petting the skin of the fur of a cat that has just licked its fur, you might be getting some pasteurella on your hands. And this can lead to direct spread in the absence of a known bite. These infections are fairly rapid in onset, and they're usually contiguous infection, but they can be hematogenous. Mycoplasma. So this is an organism which is seen primarily in individuals with immunocompromised, particularly those with humoral immunodeficiencies, such as common variable immunodeficiency or agammaglobulinemia. Most commonly, we see septic arthritis, and it may be polyarticular. This organism is difficult to grow in routine culture, but if you do have growth, you might see this fried egg morphology in culture. That should make you think about mycoplasma. Lyme. Now, this should certainly be considered in the right epidemiology. Individuals who are living either in the upper Midwest or the Northeast and may or may not have a history of a tick bite or hiking or something else that might have put them at risk. With Lyme arthritis, typically what is seen is a monoarthritis, most commonly involving the knee, but there are multiple joints that could be involved. One of the characteristic features is that the effusions are really quite large, and they also may resolve over weeks and then recur at a later point in time. So it oftentimes mimics an inflammatory, non-infectious monoarthritis. These are patients who, despite having a large effusion, are oftentimes still ambulatory. They're able to get around comfortably. This is diagnosed serologically or with a synovial fluid Borrelia PCR. All right, non-tuberculous mycobacteria. Certainly, this can cause a variety of infections, both via contiguous and hematogenous routes. Classically, this is seen with some form of exposure to water, as these are, waterborne organisms. The classic example, of course, being tenosynovitis of the hand due to Mycobacterium marinum or other non-tuberculous mycobacteria. When you consider mycobacteria, just remember, especially if it's in the hand, to ask the laboratory to incubate it at lower temperatures, because some of the organisms that grow, that cause infections in hands and feet, more commonly hands, will grow better in cooler temperatures. All right, yeasts and molds. We should always think about Candida in individuals who are immunocompromised, those who have had a lot of antibiotic exposure or on chronic antibiotics. It's also seen in injection drug use. Infection involving environmental molds, most commonly seen in direct inoculation injuries, sometimes environmental trauma, in which case it can lead to a local septic arthritis or osteomyelitis, usually a subacute to chronic form. And the classic example of that is actually the Madura foot, which is seen most commonly in the developing world, in which walking barefoot leads to inoculation percutaneously of molds, which then can lead to these slowly progressive, slowly destructive osteomyelitic infections that can progress over many years. And last but not least, endemic mycoses. Osteoarticular infection is more common with coccidioides and blastomyces than it is with histoplasma. And when you see it causing an osteoarticular infection, these are usually manifestations of disseminated infections, which are more commonly seen in those who are immunocompromised. But we do see osteoarticular infection due to these organisms in healthy hosts. The infections are usually of the hematogenous variety, like septic arthritis, long bone septic lesions like the Brody's abscess, and then vertebral osteomyelitis, in which it might mimic tuberculosis, causing that anterior type progressive disease. So that is musculoskeletal infections in a nutshell. I hope you have enjoyed the talk. I would be happy to answer questions, and good luck on your boards.